Nein, Sorge.
Oder was?
Und dann war 24 Uhr das Haus und jetzt weg und fliegen.
Okay, thank you. Like some of the other talks, I will discuss a procedure to derive effective equations for quantum gravity, which can only be used to derive semi-classical properties, but also to get some insights into deeper quantum issues. The procedure I follow is a rather economical way to analyze a quantum system. Instead of working directly with states and some kind of representation, we look at quantities of more or less physical interest, like expectation values, fluctuations, or higher moments. And the quantum system determines coupled equations of motion between these quantities. Classically, we only have equations for the expectation values, but in the quantum system, there are more degrees of freedom, and they humanly back react on these expectation values, which can be included as quantum correction terms into the classical equations. And when that's derived, these are effective equations that one can analyze much more easily than the initial equations that in which the quantum system is formulated. In a more technical sense, this allows us to derive dynamically coherent states, not fully, not as a full in a full representation, but order by order in an approximation like the semi-classical one or sometimes other approximations. Or in a more quantum field theoretical formulation, we determine the interacting vacuum state of a quantum theory that is, that does contain interactions. And usually it is difficult to find the interacting vacuum state precisely. But in this way, in these approximations, one can start with an uninteracting vacuum of a field theory, a free theory, and then include corrections to that state into the physical quantities. So all this allows us to avoid complicated representation issues, and especially in quantum gravity or constrained systems in general, also questions related to the physical inner product. And in the end, this provides a systematic route to derive more intuitive or observable quantities from an underlying theory, which might be technically or conceptually much more difficult. I first illustrate the procedure by a simple example, which is an anharmonic oscillator. So that is the Hamiltonian. And as I said, we are interested in expectation values and fluctuations rather than full states. So we compute equations of motion just as basically in the Ehrenfest theorem. We get something which is just like a classical equation for Q, the expectation value of position. But then in the equation for the momentum, we have a classical term, and also with this anharmonicity here, a quantum correction that depends on quantum fluctuations. So the system certainly is not classical, so there are corrections to these equations. But if you just have these two equations, we cannot solve this because it's not a closed system. The fluctuations themselves are dynamical, they are functions of time, and we would have to know about time dependence if we wanted to solve that equation for P. So we have to go further. We cannot just leave it with these two equations. We have to go ahead and compute equations of motion for delta Q. That can be done by similar calculations, also standard ones. Now, this equation then tells us that the time dependence of delta Q depends on further independent quantity, which is the covariance between Q and P, just basically defined by this equation. So, again, to determine the time dependence of delta Q, if you wanted to put that into the equation for P, we have to know what the time dependence of the covariance is. So, again, you compute an equation of motion, and that gives us another quantity, which is a moment of higher order, third order. There's also now a coupling term between fluctuations and expectation values. So, this still doesn't give us a closed system, and if we continue more systematically, we'll see that the process never stops. So there's no finite system of closed equations. All moments of a wave function, or which I call quantum variables, defined in this way, are required if we wanted to solve the initial equations for the expectation values. So what we have here for the quantum system is a set of infinitely many coupled equations, ordinary differential equations, which is certainly difficult to solve. And at this stage, it's still the full quantum system, we didn't do any approximation. It's really equivalent to the partial differential equation that we usually work with. So at this stage, there's no real advantage because it's easier to solve a partial differential equation for an infinitely many coupled ordinary lens. But the advantage is that there are some regimes, like semi-classical ones and others, in which one can do approximations and determine, for instance, this fluctuation term delta Q that we need here without solving the full set of equations. So in this case, for an anharmonic oscillator, the approximations we need are an adiabatic approximation for quantum variables. So we assume that all these quantities depend only weakly on time. And we also combine that with a semi-classical approximation. If we look at the equations, then one can see that this allows us to determine delta Q as a function of Q and P. We're not really solving it yet for as a function of time, but we get that approximately as a function of Q and P, which we can insert here into that equation, and that finally gives us a closed system of two equations, one for Q and P, which is of the same mathematical type as the classical equations, but it does have a quantum correction term because this delta Q here cannot be zero. So the quantum evolution is described by this correction term to the classical equations. That's a general principle. If one does this systematically, doing these two approximations that I just mentioned, we get an equation of motion, a second order, like this one for a general anharmonicity potential U. So that would just be Q cubed times lambda in the example I showed. And this is to first order in the semi-classical approximation, so there are three correction terms which are linear in H-bar. If we go to higher orders, they are additional ones. And it's second order in the adiabatic approximation. Now, the interesting thing is that this procedure, it's not just the systematic way to approximate the quantum evolution. It also, in this case, agrees exactly with an effective action that one can compute by standard quantum field theoretical techniques. It agrees with the non-particle irreducible low energy effective action that one usually uses in particle physics. That would give us an effective action like this one, and if we compute equations of motion, they agree exactly with what we derived here using these quantum back reactions. So the procedure that I just sketched is reproduces the same result in that case where other techniques are available, but the procedure itself is more general. First of all, it applies to canonical quantizations, which the usual effective action techniques don't. Secondly, it didn't really appear in the calculation I showed, but the low energy effective action is based on perturbations around the ground state of the free theory of the harmonic oscillator. That enters here in initial conditions that we need to choose for equations of motion for quantum variables. If we do that and choose initial conditions corresponding to the ground state, that will reproduce the low energy effective action that I showed. So we're not forced to do that. We can choose different initial conditions, which means we can base these approximations on perturbations around different states, not just the vacuum state or the ground state, but also excited or some other semi-classical states even. The only thing that might be difficult is that there's no adiabatic regime in some cases where we don't use the vacuum state, so the one has to be more careful sometimes with the approximations involved. But otherwise, the procedure goes through. Can also be generalized to constraint systems, which is, of course, especially important for gravity. And there's then an additional advantage because, as I said, we avoid dealing with states and explicit representations. And for constraint systems, that means we don't need to find the full physical inner product in a certain representation, which usually is quite difficult. But properties of the physical inner product for several quantities can be implemented through reality conditions just on these classical type variables that we keep in our effective equation. So also here there's a strong technical advantage and also conceptual of this procedure. As I'll show later in some more detail, one can also discuss the anomaly issue, again, for constraint systems. Also, not in a complete way, not for complete states, but order by order in some approximations, like semi-classical ones, or especially in quantum cosmology, in some kind of cosmological perturbation theory. And that also simplifies the calculations. Then I can just mention that briefly here, but often in new quantum gravity, one of the difficulties in using the Hamiltonian constraint is that it might change the graphs that it acts on, which makes calculation of expectation values difficult, and also some of these difficulties can be avoided by the techniques that I'm sketching here, and I'm stuck at this light. Can you repair it? Okay, thanks. So now if we want to apply that to quantum gravity, there's first a difficulty because we don't really have a free theory that we could use as a basis, not a standard one at least. So also it's not really related to harmonic oscillators that we could perturb around. But in quantum cosmology, there's a replacement. There's another solvable model, solvable in the sense that these infinitely many equations decouple, and we have to deal with only finitely coupled sets of equations. That happens for the harmonic oscillator. And it also happens for a certain cosmological model, which is isotropic and sourced by a free massless scalar. That is a Friedmann equation in just non-standard notation. And p phi is the momentum of the scalar. If we solve that equation for p phi, we can view the right-hand side, h here, as a Hamiltonian that generates evolution in phi as internal time rather than any coordinate time. From the classical Friedmann equation, we would just obtain p times c, but if we take the Hamiltonian of new quantum cosmology, some version, then instead of having a c, we have a sine c, so that is a Hamiltonian that we deal with. It's not obvious that this is, again, a solvable system, like the harmonic oscillator. It's not quadratic. It's a rather complicated function. But I'll show on the next slide why that is still solvable. On this slide, I make a few more technical comments. The first one is that even though I'm using this set of variables, the system really defines a larger class because we can do canonical transformations of this form with the parameter k, and that's not going to change the properties that I'm going to discuss. So the properties, if we just reinterpret our variables, are really more general, which is quite relevant for loop quantum cosmology because these two quantization schemes that you probably have heard of, at least in a last talk of this conference, the U0 quantization corresponds to k equals 0, and u bar, which is a different type of quantization, corresponds to k equals 3 by 2. So these two cases are actually included here, even though I don't explicitly write that parameter in the following equations. Now, what's also important to notice is that these two cases are really just two limiting cases of a whole range of classes of quantizations, which in some way parameterize the possible behavior of inhomogeneous quantum constraints. So that's the first comment. It refers to a larger class, but for simplicity, I only write it in one set of variables, and we just need to reinterpret our variables if we want to view that as quantizing a different model in the same class. The second comment is that this Hamiltonian is not the precise loop quantum cosmology Hamiltonian, although it is derived from it. It can be, so it's not just like in the shortcut argument. It's really a derivation, well, a simplification in a few steps, not just a single step, but several steps, starting from the full loop quantum cosmology constraint, and then arriving at the simpler form of the Hamiltonian, which makes it solvable. And one can show that this simplified model still captures the behavior of the model at large H, large expectation values of that Hamiltonian, which is the case in cosmology and isotropic models that one is usually interested in because there's a large amount of matter usually, and that makes H rather large. So the simplified model really captures the behavior that we're interested in cosmological models. Now the procedure then is as before. It's a solver of a matter, but it's stronger than just in the sense that we might be lucky enough to find a solve an explicit solution for a wave function, as you probably see later on. So that is essentially the same model that Abai, Alex, and Pahan are now studying. It's solvable in the sense that I mentioned earlier, these infinitely many coupled equations that we have for general quantum systems decouple to finitely coupled sets, and these sets can then easily be solved. So that is the sense in which I view that as a solvable model. And physically, that means that although there are fluctuations, correlations, and all higher moments, they all evolve in time, but they don't back react on the expectation value. So we can just completely ignore their behavior if we're interested in solutions for the expectation values. For instance, if we want to see if there's a bounce in this model, then we just need to know the expectation value and check if that stays away from zero. So but all that makes it much more efficient to solve these equations directly for expectation values and moments rather than solving first for a wave function and then doing other integrations to compute expectation values and moments. Both analytically and numerically, that's a big advantage. Furthermore, and actually more importantly in this context, it's also the way to derive effective equations, because as shown before, if we have perturbation terms, interactions, the unharmonicity in the previous example, or for instance a scalar potential or anisotropies, inhomogeneities in cosmology, then one can start with a solvable model. It's going to replace a harmonic oscillator and do a perturbation theory around that model to include these interaction effects in effective equations for quantum cosmology. It's again not working. Oh, it's okay, sorry. Now, so on this slide I'm going to show why that model is solvable. As we saw here, it's not obvious because the Hamiltonian is not quadratic. But we can introduce alternative variables. Instead of working with P and C, we keep P, but we replace C by that quantity J. And so that's something like a triad component, which would be P, multiplied by some type of polynomy, an exponential of a connection component. That makes the Hamiltonian linear in a certain factor ordering, which is defined by that equation. Linearity of the Hamiltonian doesn't automatically imply that the model is solvable because our variables are not canonical anymore. The bracket between P and J is not just a constant. But it's easy to work out that these variables P and J do form a linear algebra, which happens to be SL2R, and the Hamiltonian is just a linear combination of two of these generators of the algebra. And that implies that the model is solvable. It's a linear system, and for any linear system, we have this effect that higher moments decouple from expectation values. That can also be seen explicitly if we compute equations of motion for these two expectation values as before, taking the same steps as in the Ehrenfest theorem. And as we can see, there's no coupling term to fluctuations or any higher moment. There are only couplings between those two expectation values, but these are finitely many, so we have only finitely many coupled equations, which we can solve easily, so even linear, that's a general solution. In particular, we're interested in P, because that determines the volume of the universe, or the absolute value. And naively, that already demonstrates that the model bounces, because the absolute value of P goes to infinity if our internal time phi goes to plus or minus infinity. So it reaches large volume at early and late times, but smaller volume in between. However, that's not a full argument yet, because if C1 and C2 have opposite signs, then the solution is like a cinch, and at one point P would become zero. At this point, the model would enter a deep quantum regime, and actually the model itself would break down because there are some simplifications. Large H, for instance, was one reason, but there were other simplifications which required P to remain large enough. So if we have a solution of this form, where C1, C2 have opposite signs, we cannot conclude that they're the bounds because the model itself breaks down somewhere in between, even though these formal equations of the model give us infinite volume at early and late times. So these solutions don't fully tell us that they're the bounds, but there's one more step that I mentioned earlier. We have to implement the physical inner product. It's really a constrained system, although we are using that internal time formulation. But we formulated this here in complex variables. J is complex, and we have to implement reality conditions, which would automatically be done if we had computed these as expectation values from physically normalized states. But we didn't do that yet. We just computed these dynamical equations and solutions, so we still have to implement these reality conditions to make sure that what we have here as expectation values really comes from physically normalized states. So in particular, we have a classical condition that J times J bar is P squared by definition of J. Now, if we had a physical inner product, we had to make sure that this exponential of IC would be unitary operator. And we don't do that because we don't work with states, but one can reformulate this equation for the quantum expectation values. It's not of the same form because it's not linear, they're products. So there's a more complicated reality condition that also involves correlations between J and J bar or P fluctuations. But if we assume that we are looking at states which are semi-classical at large volume, or at least at one time, then these fluctuations and correlations are of the order H bar. And then one can show that the reality condition of this form for the solutions that we have here, the general solutions, imply that C1, C2 equals H squared plus some order H bar terms. So C1 and C2 actually have to have the same sign. This condition rules out the possibility of these hinge solutions, which would enter the deep quantum regime. Instead, we have just a Karsh solution in which P, or the volume, is bounded away from zero, and it's bounded away from zero by a large number because H had to be assumed large. We are describing large H behavior. So this, and this model completes the proof that there is really, that there are only bouncing solutions for states which are semi-classical at large volume. The second condition is important because versus all order of H bar terms, so if we take an arbitrary state, it might happen that these order H bar terms are really large, and they might actually make the right-hand side negative. In that case, it would happen that the volume becomes zero. Actually, our model would lose its validity. But these states can never be semi-classical at large volume. That's something I can show here. So if we want to start with a state that's semi-classical at late times like today, then the statement in this model is there had to have been a bounce. There was no singularity at any time, and there's no future singularity. Now, these were the solutions for expectation values as before. One can go ahead, compute equations of motion for... Oh, okay, thanks. So one can also compute equations of motion for expectation, for fluctuations and correlations. These are the equations. They can be solved similarly, and again, using these assumptions that we are making in the model, we get a solution also of Karsh type, just with basically twice the argument as we have it in the expectation value. And also, the bounce point of fluctuations could be different from the bounce point of expectation values. So the solutions plotted here could be symmetric if delta 2 equals delta, but they could also be anti-symmetric if these parameters differ. That is related to squeezing of the states. If they're unsqueezed, the solutions are symmetric around the bounce point. If they're squeezing, they are not. Now, these were exact solutions in this model. The aim is to derive effective equations, and in a solvable model, that's very easy. For the harmonic oscillator, for instance, effective equations are just identical to the classical equations. The effective action is identical to the classical action. Also here, if we just look at the solvable model, there's an effective Hamiltonian which describes the system precisely. It's the expectation value of the quantum Hamiltonian, and since that Hamiltonian was linear, there are no correction terms. It's just the same well, like the classical expression, except what we do, this quantum geometry implication that we use holonomies instead of connection components directly. But there are no additional terms which would give us back reaction or fluctuations on the expectation values. And as I said, that's a consequence of the solvability, so higher moments are decoupled from the expectation values. However, if we go ahead, make this model more realistic, for instance, including a scalar potential or anisotropies and inhomogeneities, then this behavior will change. So we do get additional terms. The Hamiltonian is no longer linear. We do get back reaction terms of higher moments, fluctuations, and other quantities. And in that case, it's not going to be enough to just use holonomy-type functions, periodic functions, instead of connection components in the Friedmann equation, but there will be additional correction terms from quantum back reaction as they usually happen in any quantum system. And then also the effective Hamiltonian will have additional terms. Here's an example. Here's an example how complicated these equations can become. That is an effective equation for the time dependence of P. If we keep the same model, just include a perturbative potential for the scalar field, which is this V of phi here. The first term is the one that we had in the solvable model. The second term is the correction that we get just classically. If we add a potential, then certainly the dynamics changes. There must be a correction term. And all the other lines here depend on quantum variables, on fluctuations of J and P and correlations. And these terms describe these back reaction effects of quantum variables on the expectation values. So again, we will have to know the time dependence of the right quantities here to solve our equation for P and a similar equation for J, which also has these coupling terms. That's an example where we don't have a vacuum state or a ground state, so there's no adiabatic regime. That makes it more complicated to solve for these right quantities in terms of P and J. But instead, what one can do is one can derive equations of motion for these G, as we have seen. And then instead of working with a system, just P and J, two parameters, or really three, because J is complex, we would work with a system that has these expectation values, the classical type parameters, but which has all these fluctuations and correlations, which are still finitely many because these are just moments of order 2 as independent variables. So one can still, although there's no adiabatic regime in a semi-classical expansion, one can still make sense of that as an effective system, although it is of higher dimension than the classical one. There are true quantum degrees of freedom that are important for the precise evolution of the quantum system. Now, that's an example for effective equations in an isotropic model where some of the properties that we saw are general, but there might also be other corrections. In general, what we have is something like these holonomy corrections, as we saw, so just like replacing a connection component, by some holonomy-type function. This also certainly happens in other models, in particular if it's inhomogeneous. So this will always be a correction. Moreover, if it's inhomogeneous, one has correction terms from spatial discretizations as they appear in quantum Hamiltonians. But the first type of correction, the second one, is something that also appeared in the perturbed model, including the potential. There are genuine quantum corrections, which are not specific to quantum gravity. They appear in almost every quantum system and describe these back reaction effects of a wave packet that is evolving but also spreading and possibly deforming from a Gaussian. Then there's a third type of corrections which was not included in the model because this was one of the simplifications used to arrive at the solvable model, but in general, there are further corrections because inverse triad components appear generically in Hamiltonians, and when they are quantized by loop techniques, they differ from the classical behavior on small scales. So that was ignored in the previous model, and it was not relevant for this large H behavior, but it becomes more important for inhomogeneous situations, which I'm going to discuss in the rest of this talk. So all these types of corrections will appear in this general case. But there's a further, more important issue, which is in the case of inhomogeneous constraints, which is the anomaly issue. So far, we just dealt with an isotropic model with a single constraint. There's certainly no anomalies. But if we try to incorporate these correction terms or effective equations for inhomogeneous models, then we have to face the anomaly issue. And that is, as I mentioned earlier, a further place where these effective equation techniques simplify some of the calculations and give us some insights into the viability of the full quantum theory. So, first of all, we have to follow the procedure that I described for constraint systems. That can be done. So instead of working with an effective Hamiltonian as the expectation value of the quantum Hamiltonian, we work with effective constraints, which are expectation values of the quantum constraints. Now that can be done without paying attention to the constraint, to the anomaly issue, or to the constraint algebra, because we're just computing expectation values, and there's no consistency issue in computing these expectation values. However, if there are anomalies, then there will be inconsistencies if we try to solve the constraints. So the anomaly issue is still present, but this procedure of first computing effective constraints, which look like the classical constraints but have correction terms, and then analyzing these quantum constraints makes it much more easy to analyze the anomaly issue, because now we have some of these approximation schemes, semi-classical approximations, or perturbative inhomogeneities in cosmology, which allow us to compute anomaly, possible anomalies order by order. We know that the classical constraints are anomaly free. Then at each order, we are including new terms to the constraints, and we can check if there are ways to include these quantum corrections, but still keep the system anomaly free. And if that's successful, it will provide us a consistent set of constraints, which we can then use for cosmological analysis, and it will also give us insights on the quantization, because we can check if a specific quantization implies correction terms that might or may or may not consistent with an anomaly-free effective formulation. Furthermore, since the original operators that we use have the well-known ambiguities, also effective constraints will be ambiguous. And if we go through this procedure, check if these effective constraints can be anomaly-free, then we can see if the condition of anomaly freedom fits any restrictions, possibly strong, possibly weak, and these ambiguities that are present in the underlying theory. Now, one recent result is that it is in fact possible to include quantum corrections into the effective constraints and still have an anomaly-free system. So that will be discussed in more detail this afternoon in my Kagan's talk. I don't have the equations here, but just to illustrate the procedure, the correction that's considered here is based on these inverse powers that I mentioned earlier. The correction is, of course, coming from Tiemann's quantization of these inverse powers, which in new quantum gravity require additional steps, so it cannot be straightforwardly quantized. But anyway, one can get a well-defined operator whose expectation values differ from the classical ones. And the way how they differ from the classical values of these inverse components, how they appear in the constraints, can be captured in correction functions like this. That's an example computed for a scalar mode in cosmology, a longitudinal gauge. That gauge makes it particularly easy to compute that function. In other gauges, or for other modes, also it's much more difficult, and so far we don't have an expression. So that is the function for that scalar mode. It's displayed here. And we are mostly interested in a perturbative regime. So above that peak that one can see there, where we have a certain power expansion of that function, which classically would be just one, but there are correction terms, which are these quantum corrections that we're interested in. Now, there is a correction function that arises from these inverse powers in the gravitational part of the Hamiltonian. So if we work with an effective constraint, another complete effective constraint, because we don't yet include all possible corrections at once, we just include this inverse power correction. But this still certainly changes the classical expression, and we can then follow this program. We can compute the constraint algebra with that constraint, and also including the diffeomorphism constraint, and check if there's any way to have alpha not equal to 1, to have non-trivial quantum corrections, and still have a normally free effective system. Now, it's not strictly possible yet, because, as I mentioned, we don't know the full trivial dependence of that function. We have some information. We know the dependence on the scalar mode, which is basically diagonal components of the triad, but we don't know the dependence on off-diagonal components. So instead of providing a tight check at this stage, what this procedure gives us is a conjecture. So we can start with this type of constraint, compute possible anomaly terms. These anomaly terms involve the dependence on diagonal components, but also the dependence on off-diagonal components. So by requiring that the anomaly vanishes, we get a conjecture for the dependence of that correction function on all the components of the triad, which at some point hopefully can be checked by direct calculations of that same function, which would be an expectation value like this in the full theory, and then one can see if there's a way to have a consistent full quantization which includes these corrections that always appear in any quantization of the Hamiltonian, but which still give us anomaly free effective equations, at least to the orders considered in those expansions. So I think that's a rather interesting possibility to connect different parts of calculations done in loop quantum gravity, effective calculations like here, and direct calculations of expectation values of this form involving the volume operator. Now, on the last few slides, I'll basically go ahead and assume that there is such a possibility, that the conjectured dependence on off-diagonal components is something that one can actually obtain from a full quantized operator. So I will assume that and use this as a correction to the classical equation, and then just follow the usual steps that one does to compute cosmological perturbation equations from the constraints in a canonical way. That's the result. So there are three equations, two constraints, and one evolution equation for the scalar mode that's considered here. And all these terms containing alpha, the correction, would be zero classically, but they correspond to quantum corrections to these equations. So that is now a system of equations that contains quantum corrections, which can be analyzed by the usual cosmological techniques. The analysis is not fully completed, but one can at least illustrate some of the effects. The first one can be seen by eliminating these two time components of the scalar mode by combining the equations in a suitable way. And the result is the Poisson equation for the scalar mode, for the Newton potential, basically. Mu is a function that depends on alpha, really alpha prime, so that would again be zero classically, that's a quantum correction. If that's zero, we obtain the ordinary Poisson equation with matter terms on the right-hand side and the Laplacian of psi on the left-hand side. So that would give us the Newton potential as a solution. But since there's this term, the equation also gives us corrections to the classical Newton potential, which can also be computed by analyzing that equation. The second illustration is in cosmology. We can look at the evolution equation. It's also a combination of the equations I showed earlier. There are three quantum corrections, epsilon 1, 2, and 3. The most important one is epsilon 3, because that affects a term which would classically be completely absent. So there's a possible new effect if epsilon 3 is non-zero. And in particular, if one looks at these equations compared with the classical ones, the implication is that a certain conservation law, or an approximate conservation law that exists classically, is violated if the correction here is present. And the violation of that conservation law implies that although there are only small effects due to corner corrections, they can add up in time because that particular quantity is no longer preserved. And if one goes through the numbers involved, particularly during inflation, then one can check that this actually might be visible with the next upcoming observations. But there are still some parameters involved, so that has to be made more precise. Now, since we saw that the Newton potential can be derived in this way from effective equations, together with corrections, it's interesting to compare that with the other proposal using binary propagator to derive the potential and corrections. And some of the technical ingredients are actually quite similar. In both cases, one does, of course, require properties of states, but for the precise calculations, only a finite number of parameters is relevant, like expectation values and some moments, like fluctuations in our case, and I think also for the graviton propagator calculation, it's mainly the spread of the state that is relevant to the leading orders. In contrast to the low energy effective action, which is unique because it's based on perturbations around the ground state, there's no distinguished state in either of those two examples. So there will remain three parameters, initially at least, if one just takes the basic techniques, what happens in both cases. But if one does a more detailed semi-classical analysis, which is now ongoing also in both cases, one can restrict the possible ranges of these parameters or maybe even rule out some choices completely. In both cases, there are effective techniques, the one that I illustrated here, and some others in the spin frame context that we saw earlier. So it's not yet possible to compare that very precisely, I think, but at least these technical similarities are quite promising, that we have two other different calculations of the same quantity, which at some point can be compared to give us a cross-check. So if you conclude, demonstrated here was that very effective techniques, which are now also applicable to loop quantum gravity as a canonical quantization, which are rather powerful in extracting phenomenological information, but also other quantities which are more quantum, like the bounces that we discussed, or anomaly issues which one can compute more easily, but then still get some feedback on the underlying theory, and that also refers to the physical inner product issue. So far, we haven't computed all the correction functions, but these conjectures that they provide us from anomaly cancellation provide interesting tests if there are some calculations at some point from the full theory that one can use to compare with. And another comparison is between those two approaches to arrive at the Newton potential and corrections, which I think is also very promising if the developments go on. Thank you.
Questions?
This anomaly cancellation thing is so fascinating, but I'm a little confused conceptually. I wanted to ask you probably because it's no valid classic question that you just asked this. Which constraints are an inclusive anomaly in your classing that there'll be no anomaly that you're constraining it? So between which constraints is there an anomaly? Between which
there might be one between any of these, so between H and H, and between H with a diffeomorphism.
I don't see how between one of H and diffeomorphism, and this is my confusion. Because it's true that you might change your constraint with any function of E, but so long as there's the only background field in this whole thing, which is not a non-dynamical field in this thing, is a mass, the diffeomorphism of Hamiltonian would never give you an anomaly. There's nothing from the specific form of the
Right. Well, yeah, it's also as related to the truncations involved, because we do that order by order. If we would do that for the, at least the remark I made here refers to this order by order calculation. I can also work with a full constraint, and then it's different.
So if you have one order that we develop, but then the thing is that which is not require exact normal cancellation, which does that the anomaly for cancellation only to some order. And this is what happens, of course, with all the feedback, because we have, in any approximation, we have loading levels, so which is not, it's physically incorrect to ask that the that some cancellation, some exact equation should hold at any given order. We can only ask that that equation should hold ignoring the higher order
case. Right.
So yeah. I'm a little confused about why I was asked, why I was using the anomaly cancellation at a given order as a principle to go ahead.
No, but also, yeah, the calculation is also only to the order. So, the requirement is order by order, and the calculation is order by order.
So you're saying the same. So we're saying the same.
Yeah,
we're
right.
Saying that when you say that there's anomaly cancellation, you mean that you're ignoring the higher order terms.
Right.
Not exact cancellation.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Correction to Newton logic.
So you basically solve that equation instead of just the Laplacian, and you get some exponential factor, which I think for the signs here was a periodic, an oscillating exponential. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's we didn't really compute that very precisely, because there are only additional correction terms that have to be included. But I think that gives an additional indication, at least, of what type of corrections there might be.
One question. Your correction is maybe slower. How does it compare with the correction sound of the
field theory approach that we heard about
So I mentioned that these are only partial effective constraints, and also these equations here don't include all the quantum corrections. So I think the terms that would arise from the usual effective field would really refer to these quantum back reaction terms, which I have not included here. I was rather focusing on some of these quantum geometry effects. So one shouldn't really compare these two corrections at this stage. But one can certainly also compute these quantum back reactions. It's more complicated, so that's why we start with the simpler one. But it's also possible, certainly. And then I expect it has to be the same, because we know that the procedure is basically the same as deriving effective actions in quantum field theories.
Let's take a seat here.